Case number 13-5252, National Association of Manufacturers et al. Appellants versus Securities and Exchange Commission et al. Mr. Keisler for the appellants, Ms. Hardin for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Even if it were properly construed, the conflict mineral statute would impose significant costs and burdens. But the SEC greatly magnified those costs and burdens by misconstruing the statute in several important respects and by failing to engage in reasoned decision-making in others. In particular, the Commission rewrote the statute's critical standard by changing did originate to may have originated. It categorically dismissed any de minimis exception without engaging in any serious analysis of the question. And it took a statute that's addressed to manufacturers and swept in retailers who have no manufacturing operations at all. And I'd like to begin, if I may, with a couple of those statutory and APA arguments before moving on to the serious First Amendment problem that's also present here. Section 78 MP1A states that a company must file a conflict minerals report if its minerals did originate in one of the covered countries. The Commission's rule, by contrast, says that a report must be filed if a company's minerals may have originated in one of the covered countries. That just rewrites the statute standard from did to may. Now, there's no dispute that the statute says did and the rule says may, but the Commission says it doesn't make any difference, and that's clearly wrong. If an issuer, after investigation, concludes that there is a 95% probability that its minerals did not originate in the region, then under normal parlance, no one would say that it has a reason to believe that its minerals did originate in the region. But that residual 5% possibility the other way does mean it has a reason to believe its minerals
so,
may.
So you don't have a problem, Mr. Keisler, with the part of the rule that refers to reason to believe?
Not at all.
Reason to believe is something maybe viewed as something short of did.
Well, reason to believe, we think, reflects the fact that you are never required in a standard that involves knowledge to have absolute certainty. But the question is reason to believe what? It should be reason to believe that the statutory standard is met. And the statutory standard here is did originate. And it's important to bear in mind that by changing that standard, that ultimate standard from did to may, what the SEC did here was put words back into the statute that Congress had specifically taken out. An earlier version of the bill had the formulation originated or may have originated. That was changed in the conference committee to what we currently have, which is did originate. And what the Commission did here was put the words back in that Congress had very consciously excised. And I mention that in part because the district court referenced a floor statement by a senator who used the may have originated standard and said this suggests that the statute could be read the way the Commission has concluded. But that was a statement that was made while the earlier version of the statute, the one that actually had the may have originated language, was still before the Senate, before that language had been taken out.
So can I ask the following question, which is that if you have both reason to believe and may have originated, it seems to me you're making an argument that you can have reason to believe because there's a categorical distinction between reason to believe that it may have originated and reason to believe that it did originate. And what confuses me a little bit is that when we're in the realm of reason to believe, we're already talking about something short of certainty, which seems to be the same function that's served by may have originated. So then we're talking about degrees of uncertainty, which seems like it's shades of gray rather than a categorical distinction.
Well, there may be shades, but there is a difference between did and may. We think Congress understood there to be a difference when it changed the statute to eliminate the word may and substitute the word did. I think the example that I gave earlier, in which there is a 95% probability that the minerals did not originate in the region, is an example where anybody normally thinking about how the language is used would say, there's a reason to believe it may have originated because you've got that 5% possibility. But there's not a reason to believe it did originate. I think reason to believe did is reason to believe there's a probability, not certainty, but a probability. Reason to believe may is a reason to believe there's a mere possibility. And that would be triggered really by any possibility, as the Commission has confirmed when it agrees that if there's merely a 5% chance that the minerals originated there, it would say that its standard has been met.
So if it's probability versus possibility, that's ultimately the distinction here that makes a difference, then is the nub of your argument that if it's short of 50%, that's a problem. But if it's greater than 50%, then it's okay?
I mean, that's basically right. Of course, you'll never be presented with these in precisely that sort of directly mathematical terms. But ultimately, when you're making a probabilistic judgment, you're thinking in something like that. And yes, it's the difference between something being probable and having reason to believe that it's probable.
So if the SEC had said, when we say reason to believe may have originated, what we mean is 50%. That seems like that works as a matter of ordinary parlance to me. Maybe it doesn't, but it seems like it works, and then you wouldn't have a problem with it.
Well, first of all, of course, they haven't said that. They said the opposite. They said 5% is good enough. But second, I guess I would think that was a starchier definition of reason to believe may have originated than most people would think. Most people, I think, would think that a mere possibility would be sufficient to trigger reason to believe it may have originated, because that has both the reason to believe language and the may language. And I think a 50% threshold is not how people would normally think that those words would be construed. In any event, it's not how the Commission construed it. If I can turn then to the de minimis exception, the case for careful and thoughtful consideration by an agency of a de minimis exception was particularly compelling here, where the rule's application to very tiny and difficult to ascertain uses can impose massive costs without achieving anything towards the statutory objective, even under the most generous speculation about what this regime as a whole might achieve. But the Commission said that any de minimis exception would be contrary to the statute and so refused to consider adopting any. Now, the Commission has said in its briefs that it always understood that it had explicit statutory authority to adopt such an exception, notwithstanding the contrary language in the order. But even if that were so, that would merely shift the focus of our argument and of the Court's review to the complete absence of any analysis in the order of the Commission's decision not to exercise that authority and adopt such an exception. Because once you strip out of that section all the sentences about the Commission not having the authority because Congress didn't intend it, you are left with two sentences. And in those two sentences of analysis, what the Commission said is that it agreed with the State Department that because conflict minerals are often used in very limited quantities, a de minimis exception could have a significant effect on the final rule. And the State Department's comment to which the Commission referred was also all of two sentences, equally conclusory and equally devoid of facts or analysis. And that's not surprising, because the State Department
has
a...
Do you dispute the Commission's underlying assumption there that small uses of these minerals could be significant?
No, but I think the key word in Your Honor's question is the word could. There's no doubt that if a de minimis exception were poorly formulated, you could wind up exempting individual uses that are small individually, but in the aggregate have more than a de minimis effect. But obviously that's not true of all possible de minimis exceptions, and commenters suggested other types. For example, the Commission specifically asked for comment, and commenters specifically recommended a per-company, per-issuer exemption, which would say for a single company, if all of its uses of the minerals in a year in toto across all its product lines were below a certain threshold, and one commenter even suggested as little as 1 gram, then it would not have to report. Now, there are fewer than 6,000 issuers. If half of those issuers, which is wildly optimistic, were able to take advantage of such a 1 gram exception, you would have exempted a little more than 7 pounds of minerals from the market. The Commission has never explained, and no one could explain, how that could possibly have an impact on the armed groups in the Congo or any other statutory objective.
Do you have an on-point case that strikes down a regulation by any agency for not creating a de minimis exception?
No, Your Honor, there is no case we're aware of.
Asking us to break really new ground here to reverse them for not creating a de minimis exception, right?
It is true that there is no such case, but we think the principles that we're articulating here are principles that are drawn from cases, for example, Association of Administrative Law Judges versus FLRA, where the Court upheld a de minimis exception.
Yeah, but to uphold one as being appropriate does not mean it is inappropriate to not have one.
Well, that's true, and we're not asking that the Court order the Commission to adopt a de minimis exception. We are simply making a very standard administrative law argument that the two-sentence justification the Commission did, because like any other issue, a de minimis exception, the decision to adopt it or not, once it's conceded they had the authority to do it, has to be supported by reasoned decision-making. Our only point here is that those two sentences don't qualify as reasoned decision-making. They merely note the possibility that some de minimis exceptions could have non-de minimis effects.
They have a Chevron-type analysis where they express their conclusion that Congress intended not to provide for de minimis exception. Why isn't that analysis? You cite it in your favor, but I'm not sure why it isn't in the commission.
Because it's flatly wrong, Your Honor. The Congress put this provision into a statute to which the commission's separate, explicit power to grant exemptions applies. There are two provisions, 78LH and 78MMA1, which specifically grants the commission authority to adopt exemptions, not just de minimis exceptions, broader than that, but certainly including de minimis exceptions. So that is just a misstatement of law by the commission. We think that misstatement of law would be enough to require that the order be vacated and remanded. But now the commission says it has the authority. It denies.
It didn't really say it didn't have the authority in the order, did it?
Well, the way
it says we are of the opinion that Congress didn't want us to make this de minimis exception.
That's right.
That's what I'm suggesting, that they were doing what we expect them to do when we apply our Chevron analysis, that they were construing the law to see what the otherwise possibly ambiguous statute in fact expressed.
But we don't think what they said there was supportable, because what they said is we think if Congress had intended to authorize a de minimis exception, it would have done so explicitly. But Congress did do so explicitly. It did do so in these other statutory provisions, which specifically apply to Section 78M of the Exchange Act, which is where this provision appears. And I would just emphasize the importance of this issue, and it's encapsulated, I think, by the treatment of catalysts. Because the way catalysts work, they can contain maybe one or two parts per million of tin, and they're used in the manufacturing process to create certain chemical reactions, and they're reused and generally washed away, but they're not always washed away. So sometimes a residue of this catalyst can remain on a part which maybe creates an adhesive that goes into the seatbelt mechanism of a car. So if the residue remains on the catalyst and there is a speck of tin, one part per million, then the SEC says that GM has to trace that speck of tin back to the mine. But
I thought that the rule excluded that on the basis that the only minerals involved are those that were intentionally added to the final product.
No, it very much did not. And this is the critical distinction, which is so problematic. If the way the commission divided this up, if the catalyst is completely washed away, so no residue remains on the seatbelt, then it doesn't have to be traced. But if even a tiny residue remains on the seatbelt, then what the commission says is it is contained in the product and therefore has to be traced. And, of course, GM doesn't know whether it remains or not. The only way it would know is if it tested every batch of the product that came in. This is the kind of situation that cries out for a thoughtful, sensible approach to a de minimis exception that recognizes that Congress explicitly granted the authority and that says more about it than simply that because minerals are often
There's another limitation in addition to the one that Judge Randolph pointed out about intentional addition that the SEC points to, which is that it has to be necessary. And so I'm wondering, in your understanding, if you have a situation in which there's a catalyst that's used as part of the process and it winds up at least in trace amounts in the final product such that the reporting obligation is triggered. But there's another way to make the same product that doesn't incorporate use of the same catalyst but incorporates use of something that isn't covered. Would then the necessity criterion kick in such that you wouldn't have to report it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because under the terms of the rule, they've been very specific. If the catalyst remains on the product, that's the end. They haven't drawn the distinction that Your Honor just
drew. Why? Then what does that do with the necessary part of it? Because it seems to me there's an argument that it's not necessary if you could make the product without it.
I suppose there's an argument that could be made there. I don't want to preclude the possibility of making it. It doesn't appear anywhere in the commission's order.
And it would seem that if that were true, then it would at least ameliorate the concern that you raised to some extent.
But only to some extent, because then there would be circumstances where it is necessary and you'd still have to trace or not, depending on whether that one part a million wound up not being completely washed away. If I could reserve the remainder of my time.
Sure. Or do you all have any other?
I apologize.
Judge Randolph, do you have any?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Although You know, if you're going to use rebuttal time, you're not going to be able to use it to deal with the First Amendment since you haven't raised it at all.
All right, well,
yeah, we'll give you, we'll give you some.
I think you, it's incumbent upon you, if you want to preserve that argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity. We would have no First Amendment objection if the government itself elected to denounce our products as not conflict-free. But the First Amendment precludes the government from compelling us to carry that highly ideological message written by the government to denounce our own products on our own websites and in our public statements. Now, the Commission says
so
that
the First Amendment argument deals only with the website. It doesn't deal with the other matters you were talking about the due diligence and did originate and says it's only the posting on the website.
With one addition, Your Honor, we object to having to put anything on our website. That's our space, and they're altering our message when they require us to put something on the website. But we also object to being compelled to make any public statements that our products have been found to be not conflict-free. And that would include in reports that are filed with the Commission for the purpose of being made public. What we do not object to, we do not object to a requirement that we provide the Commission with the real factual information, what minerals in our products, what mines they came from, if we can possibly find it out, what country of origin, and let them say what they want. If they want to pronounce our products to be not conflict-free, that's obviously not a First Amendment objection. So we don't object to supplying that purely factual information. But we object to having to put anything on our website, which is our space, and we object to having to, in any space, say that our products are not conflict-free, because that is an ideological judgment denouncing our products, and it is frequently going to be false or misleading, because frequently what it will simply mean is that we cannot tell where those minerals
came from.
Could
you say, it sounds like under the rule there's leeway to at least expand upon the rote disclosure and give some explanatory commentary?
That's right.
And so could you say, for example, not found to be conflict-free, and what that means is not found to be conflict-free within the meaning of the statute, which doesn't necessarily mean that there's a conflict problem here, and you could go on and explain exactly what it means under the statute,
we could,
and then there would be no misimpression.
Yes, Your Honor, but in every compelled speech case, there was always that option for the speaker to add things. In NAM, National Association of Manufacturers versus NLRB, the union poster case, the court specifically said that the ability to add additional explanation doesn't change the First Amendment problem. In Woolley versus Maynard, any driver in New Hampshire could have had a bigger bumper sticker than the one that says live free or die and say, I completely disagree. This is the state's message. But the court said that the New Hampshire citizens were being required to essentially use their cars as a mobile billboard for the state's ideological message. And it doesn't change that if you get to put other things on the billboard, too. The point is that we here have to carry this denunciation of our products, and then we have to alter our message further by explaining why the denunciation shouldn't be read to mean what it would otherwise be read to mean. And we think the First Amendment issue here is settled by two propositions that are settled law in the circuit. The first is that, contrary to the Commission's argument, rational basis review, the Zadar standard, doesn't apply here. That's what the Court said in Reynolds. It said that that applies only where a compelled speech is designed to prevent consumer deception. And the Commission has conceded that no consumer deception issue is present here. And the second proposition established by Reynolds is that once heightened scrutiny applies, the government has the obligation to present affirmative evidence, direct evidence to meet its burden, that the restriction, that the compulsion, will directly and materially advance a governmental interest. Not speculation, not conjecture, the Court said, but evidence. In that case, there were actual studies that the agency put forward, but the Court found them inadequate. Here, the agency has conceded that it cannot say whether any of the benefits sought by the statute will be achieved by this regime or not. And when the agency can't itself say that, then there's no basis for saying that the government has met its burden of showing that the compelled speech here will directly and materially advance a government interest. All the government is saying is that Congress must have thought so, because it enacted the statute.
Would you have a claim if what the agency allows you to do is to disclose on your website that you had in fact filed this document with the SEC and then explain to anybody who looked at your website where that document could be found on, say, the SEC's website, and then the SEC posts the same document?
I think it would depend on whether the document had to include our statement that our products had not been found to be conflict-free, because that is the statement of ideological opinion that we disagree with and reject and shouldn't be compelled to say in anything that we have to sign.
Do you maintain that the First Amendment analysis has to be on the or should be on the basis of the commercial speech doctrine?
Well, actually, we think strict scrutiny applies because this is unlike any commercial speech case that we know of. This isn't speech proposing a commercial transaction.
Well, as a matter of fact, it's doing quite the opposite.
That's right.
I mean, that is the theory behind the statute, as I understand it. It's to prevent or to persuade at least investors not to engage with a company that does the posting.
Right. This is a shaming statute. I mean, this is a scarlet letter statute. It's doing something very different than in any commercial speech regulation that we've ever seen. And so we have said that we think strict scrutiny applies. But we also think that the statute would easily fall under the heightened scrutiny applied to commercial speech.
Even though strict scrutiny didn't apply in RJR, the argument was made there, too.
Well, that's right. But there you were making representations to customers about the product and putting that on the product. Here we're supposed to be addressing geopolitical concerns that are part of a political debate in our website and in public reports and not at the point of sale with the customer. So this is much further removed from the kind of proposal of a transaction or advertisement that we think
was issued. Well, I guess it depends on whether you think the relevant transaction is the purchase of the product or the investment in the company. And so, for example, for the investing public who's trying to make a determination whether to invest in the company, they're getting some information about the company that determines whether they're going to buy the shares.
Well, they and everyone else are getting some information, but the Commission specifically denied in the order that the information here was necessarily material to investors. And it was very specific that this wasn't about providing information to investors. It said specifically that this is a provision that seeks to achieve social benefits quite unlike the normal investor protection benefits that our rules strive to achieve. And that's why it said there were no direct economically measurable benefits to either investors or to issuers. This is a shaming statute designed to affect a broader debate, and it's not about our commercial relations with our customers. If I could reserve whatever there is to reserve.
We'll give you some time.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the Court. I'm Tracy Harden on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. In implementing Congress's mandate in 1502, the Commission, as counsel has referred to, did have discretionary decisions to make. But in making those choices, the Commission accepted the rationality of Congress's policy choice and tied its determination to its reasonable interpretation of the statute and congressional purpose. And it's exactly that kind of determination that appellants are challenging with respect to both the reasonable country of origin inquiry and the de minimis exception that they've raised this morning. And we simply disagree that the Commission's trigger for due diligence and reporting here is contrary to the terms of the statute. In fact, the statute is silent as to the reporting obligations of issuers who do not know the origin of their minerals, as the district court recognized. And it's important, and as you know, I think your honors have recognized this morning, the appellants essentially concede that by conceding that a standard of reason to believe did originate would satisfy the statutory terms. That's a concession that there is ambiguity there for the Commission to interpret. And here, there's nothing unreasonable about the interpretation the Commission has given. And it's important to remember that the report's triggered not just by a reason to believe may have. Under the terms of the regulation and as explained in the Commission's release, a reason to believe may have gives an issuer the obligation to move on to due diligence. And it's only if that due diligence does not dispel the reason to believe that a reporting requirement is triggered. And that's made very clear in the rule and in the release.
On the reason to believe did originate, Mr. Carswell makes the point that a 5% likelihood is enough to trigger under reason to believe did originate. And do you take the position that that's right?
Under the Commission's standard, I believe he's saying reason to believe may have would be triggered by that. And I think that is right in some circumstances, but it's important to focus on what you know about that 5%, because the reason to believe may have isn't going to be triggered if you have an absence of information about that 5%. The release makes this clear. You don't have to hear back from all your suppliers. You don't have to have a certainty. So if you know that 95% of your minerals did not originate in the covered countries and you don't know about the other 5%, there's no reason to believe may have.
At what point does the website posting kick in?
The requirement to post on the website is for both a Form SD, which is sort of the basic specialized disclosure report that's triggered to say that you did engage in a reasonable country of origin inquiry and the results of that inquiry. And then also, if the issuer does file a conflict minerals report, that too is required to be posted on the website. And that is a requirement that's in the statute, so it's not something...
So it's triggered before the due diligence? There's got to be a web posting before the company engages in due diligence?
Where it's triggered, Your Honor, is if an issuer gets to step two of the rule. Now, remember, what the statute requires is public disclosure of whether any minerals that are necessary to the functionality or production of the product are, whether they did originate in the covered countries. So, yes, it's triggered at that point, at step two, but at that point, what's going to be disclosed is a Form SD, which just says we do have these necessary minerals, we've engaged in a reasonable country of origin inquiry, and if you're not moving on to due diligence, it would say, you know, we concluded that, you know, we reasonably concluded that the minerals did not originate, we're done. And so that's the only thing then that would be disclosed. If due diligence is triggered, then you would also describe that due diligence and the results of that due diligence. If the due diligence does not dispel the affirmative warning sign that you had, then you would be in sort of a full-blown conflict minerals
report. None of this detail in these various steps is in the statute, is it?
No, what the statute says is that issuers have to disclose whether their minerals originated,
right.
And if so, if they did originate, go on to provide a conflict minerals report. But what the statute is silent on and the ambiguity that the commission was interpreting here was how you determine whether your minerals originate. And in fact, the commission had comments saying that, you know, due diligence should be required in all circumstances. But the commission, recognizing that that is burdensome and, you know, having said that it's sort of North Star in its decision-making here, was to lower the cost of compliance where it could without undermining its best reasonable interpretation of congressional intent, it didn't require due diligence.
What is the congressional language from which you interpret the commission to have gained the authority to make them post this has not been found to be untainted? What is the language you interpret, the commission's interpreting?
Your Honor, the statute expressly requires website disclosure.
The statute expressly says what? That's your language. Tell me what the statute says.
Your Honor, and this is Section 1502B-E. Each person described under paragraph 2 shall make available to the public on the Internet website of such person the information disclosed by such person under paragraph A.
And that information is?
That what? Information
under paragraph,
paragraph A is the disclosure as to whether.
Read me
whether,
what it says. Don't tell me your words. They weren't interpreting your words. Tell me Congress's words.
Whether conflict minerals that are necessary as described in paragraph 2B in the year for which such reporting is required did originate in the Democratic Republic of the Congo or an adjoining country, and in such cases in which conflict minerals did originate, submit to the commission a report which includes.
But the posting part is triggered by did originate.
The
right?
Posting part is triggered by whether conflict minerals
did
that
originate.
Are necessary did originate.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct, but...
So the possibility that they have not been found to be free of such minerals, free of such origin, does not leap out at me as being what Congress was authorizing the commission to make them say on their website. This is regulation of speech, and it has some standard higher than just we think this is what Congress would like us to do, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important in determining what standard applies here to look at the entirety of what the disclosure requirement is. because this isn't, you know, we focused on sort of the ultimate conclusion of the inquiry, which is have not been found to be conflict-free. But the disclosure we're talking about is the posting of a copy of a conflict minerals report or a Form SD. And that disclosure includes a description of exactly what the issuer has done in terms of inquiry and what it's found.
Doesn't that sound like a lot more than what Congress authorized the commission to do? I mean, you refer to congressional silence, but silence doesn't empower. You're a statutory creature, and the commission has only those authorities to regulate which Congress gives to them. So does that language empower the commission to require the kind of speech that you're doing here?
Your Honor, I want to make 2 points. The first is I don't understand appellants to have made in this litigation the claim that the commission wasn't authorized under the statute to require website disclosure. That's never been a statutory claim that's been made.
I'm not suggesting that they are arguing that either. They are not saying that the statute doesn't require some sort of disclosure, but the statute requires a disclosure where they did originate, right? You read me those words twice.
That's correct. It requires disclosure of whether it did.
You're instead requiring them to issue an extensive statement that says a good deal more than that, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, although I want to point out that that context, in fact, helps issuers here. What it does is mitigate any risk that anybody who reads this report is going to misunderstand their connection to the DRC, because what you have is a very detailed description of the inquiry they engaged in, exactly what their results are, and the ultimate measuring of that against.
Maybe that's the reason why they would choose to do that. What empowers the commission to make them do that? This is speech. This is compelled speech.
Your Honor, we have not made the argument that this doesn't implicate the First Amendment. That's correct. But what I'm trying to get at is the type of compelled speech we're talking about. And the courts have been very clear that when you have a factual disclosure, that that is subject to lesser scrutiny under the First Amendment. And the argument here that this is beyond a factual disclosure.
You're taking cases that deal with, let me put it this way. Does the SEC require, either by rule or by statute, in any other instance, disclosure of something that doesn't deal with the safety of a product or investing in the stock of a public company? Is there any other instance where the SEC requires disclosure that doesn't deal with those two things?
Your Honor, I think most of our disclosure requirements, you're right, it's fair to say, are about information that would be material to investors. I think, but here what we're getting at.
Private companies don't have to make this kind of disclosure, do they?
No, Your Honor, but that was a decision that Congress made, and what we're not here discussing is a challenge to the rationality of the statute. This is a challenge to the agency's implementation of that statute.
Yeah, but these considerations bear on the matter that Judge Santel was talking about. I mean, what we have is something that you admit is within the realm of the freedom of speech, and one looks at the, whether the ends justify the means, and whether there's a reasonable fit between the objectives of the statute and the particular rule or the. But by the way, what is? Can you sum up and tell me what the objective of this statute is?
Your Honor, what the commission explained and what it took from the congressional language is that the objective is to promote peace and security in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and it has been widely recognized.
That's the end. That's the end, right? This is a means. So how is this going to accomplish that? I should have framed it that way.
Well, Your Honor, there's international consensus that the trade and exploitation of these minerals from the DRC is fueling and funding the conflict. And it has been recognized by the UN Security Council, by the public-private multi-stakeholder group in the OECD, that due diligence and careful sourcing practices can, in fact, help ameliorate that conflict.
How? Is it because there'll be a boycott by consumers of seat belts produced by General Motors, which Mr. Kaiser talked about? Or is it because investors will not buy the stock of a particular company? I mean, is that what the objective is to stigmatize the companies?
Well, Your Honor, I think what the objective is, and this is what Congress said, is to increase public awareness as to the sourcing of these minerals and to sort of decrease the funding of a black market in these minerals. The objective is, in fact, to create a legitimate market for minerals from the DRC and the surrounding region. And that would, A, lower funding to the armed groups, B, provide additional funding to the DRC government to allow it to engage in, you know, whatever policies it wants to regulate the situation there. But, you know, again,
if and only if the reporting requirements result in companies not using the minerals that may have originated in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And how is that going to happen as a result of the disclosure to the on the website?
I want to be careful here to say if and only if, not if and only if issuers are careful about sourcing from legitimate mine sites in the region, not sort of black market sources that are controlled by armed groups. So again, the objective here is more careful sourcing practices, not an embargo. And that happens by consumers and investors. You know, this is not just aimed at investors. This is also aimed at consumers and the product. And you do have in the electronics industry, for example, people marketing their products as conflict-free.
Do you agree, I guess, with the premise of these questions and with what Mr. Keisler had said, that this regime doesn't have to do with advising investors about the nature of the companies that they might be investing in?
Your Honor, the Commission in the release does, in fact, outline comments that it got, and there are statements in the legislative history that this is considered important information to investors. There were a number of, for example, socially conscious investors that told the Commission that this type of sourcing practice is material not only to their sort of social consciousness goal, but to the risks involved inherent in an issuer's supply chain, which can affect their business. The Commission did say, however, and this is true, that that's not the main objective of the statute that's embodied in its terms. And so the Commission didn't rely exclusively on that. But, you know, that is not, I want to, you know, circle back to the First Amendment here, the only situation in which disclosures, factual disclosures, get you to lesser scrutiny. And here, you know, as I think the Supreme Court laid out fairly clearly in the FAIR decision, there are, you know, only a few categories in which disclosures get heightened scrutiny, and we don't have one of those.
Is it normal for the SEC to be requiring disclosures that are directed at the consuming public as opposed to at the investor? That sounds like an FDA goal, not an SEC goal.
Your Honor, you know, again, we're not here discussing, you know, the merits of Congress's choice.
Well, you're here to answer my question.
That's
and,
correct.
And my question right then was, is it normal for the SEC to be pursuing that objective?
Your Honor, this is a somewhat unusual disclosure requirement for the Commission, and it recognized that in the release. Nonetheless, it sought to faithfully implement Congress's decision here, and again, I want to, you know, point out that this, the context of this disclosure and the fact, as Judge Srinivasan pointed out earlier, that the additional disclosure is allowed are significant for the purposes of the First Amendment analysis. The Supreme Court has told us that, not only in the Meese case, which we cite and discuss in our briefs, but frankly also in the Milovic case, which is a more recent vintage, where there was a concern that the disclosure that a law firm was a debt relief agency would have a negative connotation. And the court pointed out that the disclosure includes additional information there that they help people file for bankruptcy, and that additional disclosure was required to prevent any chance of an unfair stigma.
How does the SEC expect to enforce this statute and regulation?
Your Honor, this isn't, as with all of our disclosure requirements, they will be, you know, issuers' disclosures will be periodically reviewed.
You're not going to get a bunch of scientists that test for metals and products and so on, are you?
No, Your Honor, and I do want to touch on that a little bit.
Are these under oath? Are these certified, these disclosures?
They are not part of an annual report, so they're not personally certified by the CEO or an officer of the company like a 10-K. They are signed on behalf of the issuer, and the commission made that clear in the release. So if what you're getting at is liability concerns for filing these reports, what you have is, you know, the potential for Section 18 liability, theoretically, but I want to make clear that there are limitations there. Section 18 doesn't apply, for example, if you don't file a document with the commission. So if a issuer reasonably determines they do not have minerals that are necessary to the functionality of production and don't file a report, then Section 18 would not apply. There are also,
Private class actions result from this? I mean, suppose that an enterprising lawyer hires a bunch of chemists and they find that a certain product contains whatever mineral, and there's been no report filed. Can they bring a class action?
Well, theoretically, there would be 10b-5 liability for these reports, but again, there's a scienter requirement in 10b-5. So what we're talking about is issuers engaging in a reasonable good faith inquiry, and if they reasonably and good faith determine that those minerals aren't present.
Those kinds of suits never go that far.
I do think that there are limitations on the ability to bring a section 10b-5.
There seems to be a slippery slope problem here. You talk about socially conscious investors. I mean, is your argument, would it lead to, for example, I'm thinking of the Caskey versus Nike case and use of child labor in China to make shoes? I mean, could, under your First Amendment theory, for example, could Congress say that all companies now have to report the conditions under which their products are manufactured overseas, what the pay rate is, whether they're using child labor, whether the standards meet the OSHA standards for workplace safety? Is that the next step here?
Well, Your Honor, I think, you know, the First Amendment analysis in any of those cases would be the strength of the governmental interest. And here the appellants, A, have conceded that there's a substantial, if not compelling, interest. And that interest is borne out, again, in prior statutes passed by Congress, in U.N. Security Council resolutions, by the U.N. group of experts, by the private-public consortium at the OECD with heavy industry involvement, that there is a real interest here in promoting due diligence and disclosure for these minerals. I know that my time has expired.
I want to ask you one question, though, about the statutory, the way the statute works along the lines of what Judge Santel was, because I'm just confused by it. So as I understand it, the did originate language in 1502 A, there's got to be some stuff before the B1A, is that where I am? B1A.
Right.
That deals with the directive to the commission to adopt regulations pertaining to a catch of circumstances, which includes circumstances in which the materials did originate in the Congo or an adjacent country. And then it goes on to say, and submit a report that includes, with respect to that catch, a description of the products manufactured or contracted to be manufactured that are not DRC conflict-free. So Congress directed you to direct companies to post on their website a report that, if you assume that did originate, can be expanded permissibly to may have originated, and I recognize that that's an issue in the case that we haven't resolved. But if you assume that that happens, then the report that's got an issue is also compelled by the statute, and that report requires a description that the products manufactured are not DRC conflict-free.
That's correct.
Although
under the terms of the rule, the language has been changed to have not been found to be.
Have not been found to be DRC. So the language in the statute is that they're not DRC conflict free.
That's correct.
The language of the regulations, the rule says is they have not been found to be DRC conflict free.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I did intend to touch on the de minimis issues if the court has questions.
I mean, you can feel free to take a minute to do so if you'd like, but.
Sure. I did just want to make a couple of very quick points, which is, as I think Your Honors indicated, that not every small use of a mineral does trigger this rule. that it does have to be necessary to the functionality or production, and even there, the commission did provide guidance to try to mitigate a lot of the concerns about tracing, the contained-in requirement and the intentionally added requirement. And the reason intentionally added requirement is important, and I think this gets to sort of the GM Seafeld example, is that somebody in the supply chain knows that that mineral was intentionally added to the production process or to the product, and what its expected action was.
Is that in the rule itself?
That
intentionally added?
Yes. Yes, okay. It is. And what we're talking about...
It's not guidance.
The intentionally added... I'd have to check the reg text, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I believe it's in there, but I can't give you exact
language.
I just
don't remember.
But what we're talking about is an inquiry, again, at step one of the rule. So we haven't even reached the standard of reasonable inquiry that applies at step two. So issuers are not going to have to show this to a certainty. They are entitled to rely on the representations from their suppliers. So the example that in every instance you're going to need to chemically test, I'm not sure that's the most likely outcome from this rule. And with respect to the particular thresholds that were proposed, it is important, again, to recognize that those comments, which the Commission recognized and acknowledged in the release, did not provide any information about how they would apply as a practical matter. There's no information there about, you know, what they capture with respect to the different minerals, what percentage of the market, what number of types of issuers would be affected. And on the record it had, where there was significant comment that this kind of categorical exception could undermine the rule, the Commission made a reasonable decision here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know we had used up Mr. Keisler's time, but why don't we start out by giving you three additional minutes, and we'll see where it goes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. First, Ms. Hardin said it's important to focus on the type of compelled speech at issue here. This is the worst kind of compelled speech. This is ideological speech in which we are being compelled to denounce our own products. And that goes to the question Judge Randolph asked about what the fit is here between the ends and the means. The Commission, of course, has said it doesn't know whether there will be any advancement of the end by virtue of these means. But it's important to focus. The question would have to be whether specifically compelling us to ourselves use this slogan and put this information on our website, as opposed to providing the genuinely factual information to the government and letting the government denounce us as they wish, whether that particular difference, that compelled speech aspect of this, will directly advance the end of promoting peace and security in the Congo. And the only way in which it might be said to do that, the only actual mechanism, would be if people believe that this act of self-shaming, us saying it as opposed to the government saying it, makes a difference. But it's precisely the fact that they're attempting to make us shame ourselves that makes this more, not less, offensive under the First Amendment.
And the shaming is the conclusion that it's not been found to be DRC conflict-free.
Right, which
that's
is, of course,
the part of it that raises the...
Yes, which is, of course, not a factual statement at all. The minerals don't contain a conflict. That's a philosophical statement about what kinds of remote and uncertain connections to that war-torn region taint a company's products. Ms. Hardin also said that, and she was very careful in how she framed this in response to Your Honor's question about investor protection purposes here, that some commenters urged that this statute protects investors. Some commenters did say that. Every time in this order in which the Commission refers to that rationale, it simply notes that commenters said it. Every time that the Commission itself identifies the purpose of the statute, it's not investor protection. They deny that it's investor protection. They deny that this information is material. They say the purpose is promoting peace and security in the Congo. That's what Section 1502A says is the purpose of the statute. The extreme violence there warrants this provision. And when 1502D in the statute directs the Comptroller General to assess the effectiveness of the provision, it's not the effectiveness in promoting transparency or protecting investors. 1502D says the Comptroller General will assess the effectiveness in promoting peace and security in the Congo. So all of these provisions, all of these discretionary judgments have to be judged with reference to that statutory objective.
Mr. Keisler, I seem to recall that one particular instance, but that there are a variety of reports that are called upon by the statute after a period of time. There was one that 2 years after the effective date. Was it the comptroller or the State Department had to talk about what punitive measures?
The State Department is supposed to analyze what punitive measures might help encourage companies to cleanse their supply chain of these materials. The Comptroller General is supposed to assess the effectiveness. The State Department is to produce a map.
Was the comptroller's report within a two-year period or five?
The Comptroller General's report, at least the first one, has already come out. But the Comptroller General, after interviewing everybody, said it was too early to tell whether the statute was doing anything.
And the punitive measures report is out, right? And what that talks about is punitive measures taken by the Democratic Republic of the Congo, not the SEC.
You know, I have not reviewed that report and wasn't even sure that that particular aspect had come out, so I'm not sure of the answer to that.
I think it has. Yes.
The court is open.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. Case is submitted.